this evening, our speaker, Rashid Khalidi, and I'm going to read you a little bit. We all know that those who refuse to learn from history are doomed to repeat it. Sadly, as Khalidi reveals with clarity and surety, America's leaders seem blindly committed to an ahistorical path of conflict, occupation, and colonial rule. Our current policies ignore rather than incorporate the lessons of experience. American troops in Iraq have seen firsthand the consequences of U.S.-led democratization in the region. The Israeli-Palestinian conflict seems intractable, and U.S. efforts in recent years have only inflamed the situation. The footprints America follows have led us into the same quagmire that swallowed our European forerunners. Peace and prosperity for the region are nowhere in sight. And to talk with you about this and to talk about the book, here is Rashid Khalidi.
Thank you. Thank you very much for coming. Thank you very much for patronizing, even in its last days, one of the last independent bookstores in this area. As I go around the country on a book tour for Beacon, I realize how threatening to independent writers and thinkers the corporate grip over bookselling is. You go into a Barnes & Noble, you're supposed to hiss when I say Barnes & Noble, or you go into a Borders, or you go into one of those corporate bookstores. The people there don't know anything about the books they're selling. They're minimum wage employees. They're maybe nice people. But they don't have anything to do with buying the books. They don't have anything to do with displaying the books. Those are made decisions made at corporate headquarters. They're not responsive to the people who buy in the store. They're not responsive to the people who work in the store. They're not responsive to the community. They're not responsive to intellectual trends. They're responsive to something that is driven by the bottom line. It's a very bad thing. For publishing, it's a very bad thing for independent thought. So I can only second what you just heard. Patronize independent bookstores. They're the last best hope of free thought in this country. And I'm really sorry this place is closing. It's the first time I've ever been in here, but I'm really sorry to see it's going to be going. Okay, I want to do a couple of things this evening. I asked, how long do you want me to talk? I'm on the last day of a 4-day book tour. And I've published 5 books before this, but they were with academic presses. Publishing with an academic press is like having them print a couple thousand copies of your book, put them into a canvas sack, weight it with lead, and throw it into the sea. They don't market. They don't sell. They don't care. Beacon is an independent bookseller, a publisher that is not driven by a corporate bottom line, but they're serious people, and they really want to sell this book. So they've had me on a really extraordinarily well-organized tour. I was doing interviews, some of you may have heard, I hope, some of those interviews, on KPFA, KPFK, every K on the West Coast, I think I was on in the last 3 days. So it's been a very long tour for me. Let me begin by summarizing 5 of the main themes of this book. The first one is that a military occupation, which has no international legitimacy, engenders resistance, always and everywhere. This is true in Iraq. It's true in the occupied West Bank and Gaza Strip. It's true everywhere. It's always true. It wasn't true in Germany and Japan because those were occupations which were perceived not just by the world, but very quickly by the Japanese and the Germans themselves as legitimate. World War II was fought by a coalition of nations which called itself the United Nations, and which created an organization called the United Nations Organization after World War II. That's who fought World War II. It wasn't just us. It was everybody, essentially, in the world, except the Nazis, fascist Italy, and Japan. And in the wake of that war, the occupations that were established in Germany and Japan were perceived as absolutely legitimate in international terms, including by the Japanese and the Germans themselves. The people who've written about the occupation of Japan have pointed out that within a couple of months of the destruction, the incineration of Nagasaki and Hiroshima, American officers were able to bring their families to live in Japan. It was so safe. There was no resistance. There was a complete acceptance of the legitimacy of that occupation, even in Germany, where there was some bitter, dead-end resistance by diehard Nazis. Very quickly, there was an acceptance that this was an inevitable and legitimate occupation. That's not the case in Iraq. So that's my first point. My second point in this book, and this is the Middle East history that you have to understand why what is happening in Iraq is happening, is that the peoples of the Middle East have strongly resisted Western control over their countries and over their resources for more than two centuries. Algeria, Morocco, Tunisia, Libya, Egypt, Yemen, Syria, Lebanon, Palestine, Iraq, Dhofar, South Yemen, all of them, without exception, decade after decade, resisted European control. Most of them fell under European control. That did not stop them. The French, for example, in Syria, just to give you one example, had to bombard their way into Damascus in 1920, were driven out of the city by a revolt in 1925 and 26, bombarded their way back into the city, artillery, killing maybe 1,400 people, and in 1945 had to bombard Damascus a third time to keep control of it. The British had to fight their way into Iraq in 1915, 16, 17, were almost driven out of Iraq in 1920 by a revolt, and there was another revolt in 1941. This is not to speak of low-level resistance that continued. Same thing can be said for Morocco. The same thing can be said for Algeria. One could go on and on and on. So the second point of this book is that these peoples have strongly resisted Western control over their countries and over their resources throughout the two centuries during which Western powers tried to subjugate them. The third point, and this is something that I do not think many people know about the modern history of the Middle East, is that there is a strong tradition, a strong trend in favor of constitutions, in favor of constitutionalism, and in favor of the limitation of the absolute power of the state, as well as strong aspirations for democracy in the Middle East. And this is not new. This is not something that has just come up. There was a constitution in the Ottoman Empire, which included Egypt, all of Turkey, most of the Eastern Arab countries, Iraq, Syria, Lebanon, and so on. In 1876, they had elections in 1877, in 1908, in 1912, and 1914. There was a constitution in Iran in 1906. In other words, there were constitutions in many parts of the Middle East before Portugal, before Russia, before most of Southern and Eastern Europe had constitutions. The Middle East had fragile, weak, but nevertheless surviving constitutional regimes. So the idea that these ideas are alien to these people or they've never had democracy is simply not true. The sad fact is one of the most serious problems that the peoples of this region had with democracy is that their democratic experiments were very frequently not supported by the great Western powers. Britain, the mother of parliaments, which was democratic at home, was not democratic abroad. British control of Egypt, for example, was marked for 30 years, during which Egypt had a parliamentary system from 1922 to 1952, by constant British interference to prevent the nationalist party that would have forced the British to leave Egypt from holding power. So in those 30 years, that party was only able to rule for 12. In other words, the democratic experiments in these countries were sabotaged and undermined by Western powers, democratic Western powers, Britain, France, which wanted control of these countries and knew that democratic governments, representing the will of the people, would have denied them that control. It's true. Democracy has had a terrible time in the Middle East, especially in the Arab world, in the last few decades. I go into some of the reasons for that in the book, but the idea that there's no democratic tradition in this part of the world is false. There is a democratic tradition. There are strong aspirations for democracy in the Middle East. The fourth point that I try and make in this book is that oil has been controlled by outsiders for most of the 20th century in the Middle East, and that this has led to great sensitivity among the peoples of this region about foreign control of their oil. From the moment oil was discovered in Iran in 1901, first Middle Eastern country where oil was discovered in commercial quantities, until the late 60s, or sometime in the 1960s, in some cases the 1970s, everything about the production of oil was controlled by foreigners. How much oil was produced, at what price it would be sold, how much money each country would get These were things that were not determined by the people of these countries. These were things that were determined by foreign oil companies. So there was almost complete control of every aspect of exploration, production, pricing, and profit from oil by foreigners. People in this part of the world are extremely sensitive about this issue. I talk in the book about what happened in the 60s and 70s and why more of the revenues that these countries finally got didn't end up going to the people. The last point that I try and make in the book, or the last of the main points I try and make in the book, is that the question of Palestine was a major factor in alienating people all over the Middle East from the Western powers, starting in 1917 with the Balfour Declaration, continuing through 1947, the partition plan, and even more so today. What I try and show in this book is that what is really most important is not, in what we do in the Middle East, is not so much our intentions. That is important. It's how people there perceive us. It's what they think we're doing. It's the historical context against which they read our intentions or our words. People in the Middle East are apt to judge the West, and in particular the United States today, by its actions rather than by the words of its leaders. And I'm going to read you a few words and explain to you why I say this. The first is in archaic English, so you can guess how old this is. O ye Egyptians, they may say to you that I have not made an expedition hither for any other object than that of abolishing your religion. But tell the slanderers that I have not come to you except for the purpose of restoring your rights from the hands of the oppressors. Restoring your rights. This was Napoleon Bonaparte in his declaration to the Egyptians, which was made in Arabic, in Alexandria, in July of 1798. So Napoleon came to restore the rights of the Egyptian people, he told them. The Egyptian people, within a few months, had decided that that might not indeed be the case. They rose up against the French army. They assassinated the commander of the French army in Cairo. And were it not for the ability of the French to mass their artillery in the citadel overlooking the city and bombard the city, the French would probably have lost control of Cairo. So within a few months, the Egyptians had decided that the actions of the French were not in keeping with their words. Let me read you some more words. A little more modern, but only a bit. Our armies do not come into your cities and lands as conquerors or enemies, but as liberators. It is the hope and desire of the British people and the nations in alliance with them that the Arab race may rise once more to greatness and renown among the peoples of the earth. That was General Maud, the commander of British forces in Mesopotamia, on his entry in Baghdad in a proclamation that was translated into Arabic and distributed in March 1917. Within less than 3 years, actually 2.5 years, almost the entirety of Iraq had risen up in revolt. The British had to use air power to bomb the tribes, killing about 10,000 Iraqis. We don't have an exact number. They didn't count Iraqi casualties then. They don't count them now. We still don't know exactly how many. In the sources I've checked, I get a range from 8,000 to 12,000, but probably about 10,000. 2,000 British soldiers, or I should say British and Indian soldiers, mainly Indian, in fact, were killed in suppressing this revolt. The last words I'm going to read you, a little more modern. Unlike many armies in the world, you came not to conquer, not to occupy, but to liberate. And the Iraqi people know this. This was our very own Donald Rumsfeld, speaking to U.S. troops at Baghdad Airport on April 29th of last year, in fact. And we have seen that the Iraqis, in time, came to view these words as not necessarily representing their understanding of what the United States was doing in Iraq. I argue in this book that our country has entered on an extremely dangerous new phase of its very long encounter with the Middle East. In fact, the United States has had involvement with the Middle East for more than a century and a half. Most of you are probably unaware of this, but until a couple of decades ago, the United States was extremely favorably regarded across the Middle East. We were perceived as a country engaged in philanthropic activities, in creating educational institutions, medical institutions, with absolutely no ulterior motives. And as a non-colonial power, indeed, occasionally as an anti-colonial power. Three of the most prestigious universities in the Middle East, the American University in Beirut, where I taught for 7 years, American University in Cairo, where my wife graduated, and Boğaziçi University, formerly Robert College in Istanbul, are testaments to the work of the people who, in the 19th century, established these institutions and did so, unlike the French and the British, without any hope of using them as a means of obtaining influence over these countries, of dominating these countries, of turning these countries into colonial domains of the United States. President Wilson's 14 points were received with rapture in the Middle East. The idea that peoples were entitled to self-determination was a revolutionary idea when President Wilson said it during World War I. And the United States was so popular that when Wilson sent a commission of inquiry to look into what mandatory power the peoples of Lebanon, Syria, Palestine, and Jordan wanted, overwhelmingly they responded, "We would prefer an American mandatory." That's how popular the United States was during World War I. After World War II, things changed. But even after World War II, the United States maintained a reputation not just as a non-colonial power, but in some cases as an anti-colonial power. British and Russian troops who had occupied Iran during World War II, together with American forces, wanted to stay. Britain and Russia both wanted to maintain the control over Iran that they had exercised for the better part of the 20th century. It was the United States that forced them to withdraw. The British and the Russians were trying to establish some kind of control over Libya after World War II. It was the United States, which in the United Nations, prevented them from doing so. In Egypt, the British were trying to keep their bases in the 40s and the 50s. The United States supported the Egyptian government. And when the British finally left in 1954, they came back through the back door during the Suez War. But in any case, when the British finally left in 1954, the Egyptians were very grateful to the United States for helping support them to get British bases that they did not want in their country out. Similarly, in Algeria, the United States pretty consistently supported the Algerians against the French. So we were perceived as a non-colonial and in some cases an anti-colonial power, and our image in this region was very, very good. That changed. That changed during the Cold War. That changed as the United States tried to establish bases that in some cases were unwanted in this region. That changed as the United States supported regimes that were undemocratic, in order to obtain strategic advantage or privileged access to oil. That changed as the United States came to be seen as a great power, which in its struggle with the Soviet Union didn't really care during the Cold War, didn't really care about the peoples of this region. But our image was not terribly bad right through the 60s. This is changing now as a result of Iraq and to some extent as a result of what's happening in the Palestine-Israel situation. Another point I argue in this book is that no power has tried to occupy and refashion a Middle East state in the way we are doing in Iraq since World War I. Nobody has tried this. The British and the French after World War I did this in a vast swath of the Middle East. But nobody has tried it. I would suggest that their experience is extremely relevant and is in fact vital to Middle Eastern perceptions, to our understanding Middle Eastern perceptions of what we are doing in Iraq. You know, it's not enough to say our motives are pure. It's important also, and I'm not necessarily sure that our motives are pure, but that's another issue. Let's leave that aside for the moment. We are operating in an environment in which people have a lengthy history. In fact, they have more history than anybody else. They have millennia of history. Mesopotamia, Babylon, where Alexander the Great died, was an ancient city with millennia of history when Alexander died there in the 4th century B.C., Egypt had 3 millennia of civilization when Julius Caesar conquered it. So these are places with lengthy histories. These are places where they pay a great deal of attention to history. These are places where they pay attention not just to their ancient history, but to their recent history. And so the things that I've read you from General Maud's statement in Baghdad or Napoleon's proclamation off of Alexandria in 1798 are things that are in their textbooks. They know about them. Everybody in the Middle East knows about these things. We may not know about them, but this is it's against this background, it's against this history that they judge what we do. I want to try and make a few points about what I think the Bush administration really intended to do in Iraq. I would argue that it's really important, particularly given that most of the pretexts that the Bush administration gave for the war in Iraq have proven to be spurious. It's really important to think carefully about what they really were doing there. They talked about weapons of mass destruction, and they talked about links between Iraq and the people who attacked us in September of 2001. These were completely spurious, completely false assertions. It may well be, I think it's probably true, that many people in the administration knew perfectly well that they were lying through their teeth. But in any case, whether they were deceiving us or whether they were deceiving themselves or whether they were being deceived by somebody else, the point is, these were deceptions. These were not really the reasons that we went to war in Iraq. And I believe that everybody now knows that. I think that the Iraq war was fought for a number of reasons. In my view, and I argue this on the basis of the words of the senior policymakers in this administration in the book, and you have to read, I think, the book to understand why I say what I say. In my view, Iraq was meant to be the first step in a new strategic doctrine whereby the United States would be unconstrained by any fetters, by any limits in its action in the world, unconstrained by allies, unconstrained by international law, unconstrained by international public opinion. It would be able to act in a way which would force the behavior it desired on others if the normal forms of coercion failed. There is some extraordinary language in the national security doctrine enunciated by the president in 2002. There's some extraordinary language in his State of the Union messages of 2002 and 2003, where he talks about compelling nations to do certain things, compelling nations to act in certain ways, in which he uses terms like dominance, establishing American dominance. These are not random words. They're words developed by people like Richard Cheney. They're words developed by people like Colin Powell, Paul Wolfowitz, the senior policymakers in this administration since the early 90s, when many of them worked in the Defense Department of President Bush's father, and they put together the defense policy guidelines for 1990, 91, and 92. The same strategic logic of unfettered hegemony, domination, dominance, is there in their thinking 12 years ago, 13 years ago, 14 years ago. And in my view, Iraq, in the first instance, was meant to be a sort of a test bed or a guinea pig for this doctrine. The United States, the Bush doctrine, is the United States can do anything it wants, anywhere it wants, to anybody it wants, and nobody can do anything about it. The other aims of the Bush administration can be summarized very simply. There was a clear desire to establish long-term military bases in Iraq to replace the bases we have actually now removed from Saudi Arabia. In 1991, in the wake of Saddam Hussein's invasion of Kuwait, the United States basically told the Saudis they had no choice. They didn't want bases, but if they wanted us to repel the possible Iraqi attack on Saudi Arabia, if they wanted us to liberate Kuwait from the Iraqi occupation, they would have to accept something that Saudi public opinion was really very resistant to, which is to say bases on Saudi soil. Those bases were universally unpopular with this entire spectrum of Saudi public opinion, not just the loonies, not just the extremists, not just the people who have actually been carrying out attacks on Americans. The most pro-American, most business-oriented, most American-educated people in Saudi Arabia were extremely unhappy with the idea of American bases on their soil. And even the Pentagon recognized that this was something that probably wouldn't be a good idea. So establishing bases in a country which would have a pliable, friendly regime, in my view, was a second objective of the Bush administration. And I think they still have not fully abandoned their desire to maintain an American military presence in that country, though their ability to do so, in my view, is dwindling. A third objective of this administration was to secure privileged access to Iraq's oil. Iraq has the second largest proven oil reserves in the Middle East. It's a country that has not been very well explored, especially in recent years. It probably has much more oil than we know or than the Iraqis know, because serious exploration, the kind of exploration that's been done in most of the rest of the Gulf countries, would probably reveal infinitely larger reserves than the proven reserves they have now. The top people in this administration, from the president to the vice president to Condoleezza Rice, who, as you know, has an oil tanker named for her, are not strangers to the oil business. They know a lot about oil. I mean, it's one of the few things they really do know about. Well, besides the defense industry. And they, I think, understood exactly how crucially important Iraq's oil is. And I think that establishing a privileged position in that country in terms of its oil was another objective of theirs. Not the first, not the second. I would argue it's the third of their objectives. It was linked, in my view, to their desire to turn Iraq into a place where their free market ideologies could be unleashed on a captive population. A friend of mine who works in the International Committee of the Red Cross and helped to rehabilitate Iraqi hospitals immediately after the war was shocked to find that the people flying in from Washington, who knew absolutely nothing about Iraq's healthcare system, had as their objective, had as their assignment from the people who run the occupation to this day in the Pentagon, the establishment of HMOs and insurance companies in Iraq. I kid you not, that is the vision. They are going to privatize that whole country. They're going to turn their health care into exactly the same sparkling model that we have here. Or they were going to. And they were trying to do that across the board, as is often the case, as was the case in Russia, when the Soviet system collapsed, communism disappeared. What privatization essentially meant was theft. Private interests took over the public goods. Little noticed in this country, but much reported in the Middle East, was the privatization of Iraqi Airways. Iraqi Airways put up all the capital of Iraqi Airways. A shadowy group of investors from Jordan and Iraq, not clear who they were, put up their expertise. The shadowy group of investors have 51% control of those assets today. You may say, what assets could Iraqi Airways possibly have? I mean, you know, a bunch of clapped-out Boeing 727s. Well, they may have some clapped-out Boeing 727s, but they have gates, landing rights at Heathrow. Do you know how much a slot at Heathrow is worth? They have landing rights at Malpensa. They have landing rights at Charles de Gaulle. They have landing rights all over Europe. They also own every commercial airport in Iraq. They own the land of all of the airports in Iraq. The Open Society Institute of George Soros has an accountability project. They have estimated the value that was just 51% of which is just handed over to this group of carpetbaggers as $3 billion. That is the kind of bonanza that this privatization involves. And that is when I talk about it as a playground for the ideologues, the free market ideologues of this administration, this is what I'm talking about. The final objective of the Bush administration, in my view, was to finish up some of the unfinished business of the Cold War, to knock off one of the last of the nationalist regimes which on occasion had stood up to the United States, and to show that, in fact, it could do anything it wanted to do. This was linked to the first objective, but in the eyes of many of the people who formulated the ideas for this war, this was linked to an ulterior motive. This was a government that was seen as not just a government which had occasionally caused problems for the United States, but also a government that had occasionally caused problems for Israel. And I say that this was their aim because they themselves said it was their aim. In a document written by Richard Perle, who was chairman of the Defense Advisory Board until he was forced to resign for a variety of reasons, written by Douglas Feith, the Undersecretary for Policy in the Defense Department, the man who planned the occupation of Iraq. That is to say, he was in charge of the planning for the post-war occupation, and he's the man who has run the post-war occupation of Iraq. He's the man who should be held responsible for everything that's happened in that post-war occupation. And finally, a man named David Wormser, who is Vice President Cheney's Middle East specialist in his national security staff. These three guys wrote a policy document for then-Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, in which they said what I've just said. This is a country that's dangerous and problematic to Israel. Its regime should be overthrown. They also talked about a bunch of other things that they wanted to do in the Middle East. My point is, this was not just an objective that these people wanted to achieve because the United States had had problems with Saddam Hussein. Of course, it had. But because they felt that this would benefit both countries, and they saw that these were two countries whose interests were identical. Again, this is a document that they wrote in 1996. I refer to it in the book. You can go. It's still up on a website. And among other things, this document reveals that none of these people knows the slightest thing about the Middle East. They don't know the difference between Sunnis and Shia. They do not know who the Hashemites are. And I kid you not, read the document. It's quite extraordinary. So these were among the reasons that the Bush administration, in my view, the real reasons that the Bush administration wanted to wage war in Iraq. I do not think that it was because of weapons. I do not think it was because of any putative links between Iraq and terror. There were no links between Iraq and the people who actually attacked us, certainly. And I frankly do not believe that these were people who fought a war to bring human rights and democracy to Iraq. Now, why do I say that? I say that because if you go to the National Security Archive at the University of Maryland, which has a wonderful website, any student of the United States and its policies should be looking at this, you will find a collection of documents dating from the 1980s. And at the top of these 80-something documents, which are documents from our government archives released under the Freedom of Information Act, you will find a picture of one Donald Rumsfeld about to throw himself into the arms of one Saddam Hussein in 1983. He was there in order to improve American-Iraqi relations at a time when the United States was helping Iraq to develop, among other things, weapons of mass destruction. One reason that we knew they had them at a certain point was because we helped them to procure them, and we helped them to defend themselves in the Security Council when right-thinking people wanted to condemn them for using them, first against the Iranians and later on against their own people. We were running interference for that government when it was using gas against the Kurds and against the Iranians. So I have a sense that these are people who never once have shown any interest in democracy or human rights in Iraq, and that this was not really their motivation. There are other reasons I have for saying that, but again, please, read the book. In fact, the aims that I've talked about were aims on which all of the major groups which contribute to the foreign policy making of this administration agreed upon. Whether we're talking about people like Rumsfeld and Cheney, who I call in the book muscular nationalists, whether we're talking about the policy intellectuals, most of whom are neoconservatives, or whether we were talking about the evangelical extremists who form a core element of the president's political base. All of these people, in my view, agreed on all of these aims that I've talked about. They're the groups that make up the president's war cabinet. They're the groups who are the closest to the president. And they're the groups who've kept anyone who has views that in any way contradict theirs from getting anywhere near the president. They form a sort of Praetorian guard around him. I have many former students who work in different parts of our government. And I promise you, none of them has access. None of these people, they're experts. They're people whom we've trained. We, the American people, we pay their salaries. We pay for them to learn Arabic and Farsi and whatever. We send them abroad to learn about these cultures. This expertise that we have paid for was kept away from decision-making because they were going to tell these guys the occupation isn't going to go easily. The Iraqis have nationalism, which may lead to this and that and the other problem. This is not going to work the way you people say it's going to work. The advice that you're getting from Ahmed Chalabi and other exiles is pie-in-the-sky advice. What you're being told by these people and by the defectors that they're trotting out for you is not true. So whether in the intelligence community, whether in the State Department, whether in the uniformed military, the expertise that we have paid for was not used by this administration. Instead, people from these three broad trends that are that really drive Bush administration foreign policy are the ones who, in effect, formed a Praetorian guard around the president and didn't let any advice, any ideas, any facts that contradicted their views get up there. What I describe this administration as having is a fact-free, faith-based foreign policy. They don't want to hear anything. They don't want to hear anything that contradicts their beliefs, and they don't want to have any facts that contradict fact-free, faith-based foreign policy. To explain the fiasco that the occupation of Iraq has become, in my view, it's necessary to understand that this was a war waged and an occupation that has been run in the complete absence of expertise. It was run entirely by people who knew exactly what they wanted to do, but did not want to hear anything that contradicted them. There has been a constant struggle within the administration over this. And one of the things we are now seeing is that the people whose advice has been systematically ignored, including the entirety of the uniformed military, are finally beginning to burst into the public with what they have to say. People in the Judge Advocate General Corps are finally saying, for example, ignoring the Geneva Conventions will harm American servicemen and women should they fall captive. The Geneva Conventions protect us. They don't just protect Iraqis or Afghans. They protect us. We're the ones who have bases all over the world. We have the ones who have soldiers who are going in harm's way. We are the ones who have people who may get captured. When Senator McCain said the other day, when I was a prisoner in North Vietnam, I was never subject to the kind of humiliation that people in Iraq were subjected to. What he was saying, he had two arms broken under interrogation in North Vietnamese prisons. What he was in effect saying was to speak, what he was in effect doing was to speak for his fellow veterans who understand perfectly well, as do the entire top brass of the military, that trampling all over the Geneva Conventions is not in the interest of the United States. It is not in the interest of our servicemen and women. We're now finding the same thing happening with the State Department. We're now finding the same thing happening with the intelligence community. They're finally beginning to understand that what has been happening is that they have been excluded from, they have not been allowed to offer their advice. Obviously, in our system, our elected officials and the people they appoint at the top of the executive branch should make policy. But I don't think I've ever seen an administration in which that policy was made in the complete absence of anything coming up from the bureaucracy. I mean, obviously, they have a responsibility to make decisions. We elect them to do that. And I would not want the generals to make the decisions. I would want elected officials to make those decisions. That's the way the system is supposed to work. But at least, for God's sakes, listen to them and then say, okay, no, we'll do it some other way. That is not the way it's happened. In my view, the only important question left in Iraq is when this occupation will end and how bloodily. There's no question but that it's going to come to an end. And it's going to come to an end, in my view, all too late because of the stubbornness of this president and of his administration, their unwillingness to admit that they've taken us on a bad course. In my view, no good could have come of what they did in Iraq. This was an adventure that was misbegotten from the beginning. Nothing that the Bush administration said about Iraq, except that Saddam was a tyrant. He was a tyrant. He abused his people in a way worse than any other Middle Eastern regime. But nothing else they said proved to be true. None of their intentions proved to be sincere. And in my view, there is no way that this adventure could have been redeemed. People say, could it have been done right? Well, only a minimal level of competence might have prolonged this. As it happened, that was not present. There was not even the most minimal level of competence in what they did. As it is, in my view, the maintenance of the American military presence in Iraq is going to lead only to a greater effusion of anti-Americanism in Iraq, in the Middle East, and in fact in many other parts of the world. And I think that we are now facing a situation where Iraq is generating a level of anti-Americanism the world over on levels that I myself at least have not seen since the Vietnam era. In my view, what we have done in Iraq has been the best possible gift to terrorists who really hate us the world over. Not just people who don't like our policies. That's what most anti-Americanism is. They don't hate our values, but they don't like our policies. But people who really want to harm us are using this as a recruiting, for a recruiting drive. We have, in effect, helped them by what we have done in Iraq. This is the worst thing that could possibly have been done. In my view, there are no longer any good options for the United States in Iraq. There are really only bad ones left. This occupation, according to the polls that are taken in Iraq today, has lost whatever support, and these are polls taken by Gallup and so forth. These are apparently fairly reliable polls. 80% before the prison scandal, 80% of Iraqis considered the United States an occupation force and wanted to see us leave. This occupation has lost whatever support it once had among Iraqis, and at the beginning, there was a high degree of toleration for it. And it is now rejected by an overwhelming majority of Iraqis. The Iraqi national consensus among both the Shia majority and the Sunni Arab minority, at least, is now overwhelmingly anti-American. Indeed, there's been a notable rise of Sunni Shia solidarity in opposition to the United States over the past couple of months. People say, well, if we withdraw, this country is going to fall apart. It's an artificial country. Well, yes, Iraq is an artificial country in the sense that its borders were drawn up by the British and the French before, during, and after World War I. But what is true of Iraq is also true of about 190 countries in the United Nations today. They're all artificial countries. They all had frontiers drawn by colonial powers. Most of them were independent long after Iraq. Most countries in the world achieved their independence after World War II. Iraq was independent in 1932, decades before most African or Asian or other third world countries. Yes, it's an artificial country, but it's no more artificial than most others in the world today. And in fact, it has developed a strong nation-state nationalism. This was shown during the aggression that Saddam Hussein launched against neighboring Iran in the 1980s, when the overwhelming majority of Iraqi soldiers who were Shia fought against Shia Iran. They obviously believed that this was their country, even though the war it launched against Iran was, in the eyes, I think, of most people in the world, an unjust war. There are other evidences that there is such a thing as Iraqi nationalism. There are other evidences that even though this country is recent, it's only 80-odd years old, even though it is artificial, like most other countries on the face of the earth, over the last four generations, it has developed a certain sense of national solidarity. It may fall apart. I think that those people who advocate dividing it up are not doing the United States or the Iraqis or the Middle East any service, because breaking up Iraq could well lead to a process which could be very destructive for all the neighboring countries, all of which are also artificial. Syria is no less artificial. Saudi Arabia is no less artificial. Kuwait is no less artificial. Even Turkey, in its relations with its enormous Kurdish minority, has some serious problems. And breaking up Iraq is going to exacerbate all of those problems. In my view, the least bad alternative today of several bad alternatives, and they're only bad alternatives, I have to repeat that, is to declare when we are going to leave, finally and permanently, to declare that we will cease attempting to control outcomes in Iraq, to declare that we will cease interfering in Iraq and will cease trying to privatize the Iraqi economy, and to declare that the United States will have no military bases in Iraq after a specific date, and to hand over the transition function to a sovereign, independent Iraqi government to, if the United Nations will take it, the United Nations, to a group of regional powers together with whoever else will do it, if we can find them. The United States' military presence in Iraq is no longer, if ever it was, a factor for stability or a factor for security. It is a factor for instability and insecurity. We are very lucky people. We have never been occupied. We do not know what it is like to have soldiers in body armor, in main battle tanks, on our main streets, not speaking English, scared to death with people sniping at them and using their weapons in our streets in self-defense. We do not know what it's like. We don't know what it's like to have guys kicking down doors in the middle of the night because somebody told them that there was an insurgent in this house and dragging people out while the kids scream. We don't know those things. We've never experienced them. People in most of the rest of the world, unfortunately, have had to put up with that kind of thing. We've never had to do it. We do not understand what kind of situation we have put our soldiers into in Iraq. No good can come of this. If this occupation had been legitimate, if it had been perceived as legitimate by the Iraqis, most importantly, all of this might not have happened. But it has now happened, and there is no way to undo the things that we have done. Let me say two more things before I stop. The first is, anybody who knew anything about Iraqi history, including every Iraqi I know, knows the story I'm about to tell you. I believe there is nobody in the top civilian ranks of the Pentagon who had any inkling of what I'm about to tell you. There's a small town, the western bend of the Euphrates. It's on an ancient desert highway, which runs up from what is today northern Saudi Arabia to Aleppo in Syria and Mosul in northern Iraq. Along that highway, for millennia, people have moved. Goods have moved. Ideas have moved. People are related up and down that highway. In the southern part of it, what's now northern Saudi Arabia, is a tribal confederation called Shammar. It's called Jabal Shammar, Mount Shammar, or the hills of Shammar. And those people are related or have some kinds of links of kinship with tribes up and down the Iraqi desert, up and down the Syrian desert, and up and down the Jordanian desert. This little town, which is on that western bend, if you think of the desert as a sea, it's like the westernmost port that sticks out there. So it's the place where people stop, up and going up and down. And it's not just people who go up and down that highway. It's ideas. So when the ideas of the Wahhabi movement developed in northern Saudi Arabia in the 18th century and continued to influence people in that region. Those ideas would travel up and down that route together with people. So this little town is one of the strongest strongholds in Iraq of Salafi Wahhabi thinking. This is not new. This is not something that happened when, you know, General Sanchez was appointed or when the British established the frontier between Iraq and Saudi Arabia. This is stuff that goes back to the 18th century. Okay? Finally, this little town is where, in 1920, when the British found they were having difficulty with the local tribes, they sent their most experienced, most callous, most hardened official, a man named Colonel Leachman, who was notorious for his brutality and for his ruthlessness. Leachman got into a dispute with the local leader, a man named Sheikh Dari, and in the altercation that followed, Leachman was killed. This was the spark that set off the 1920 Iraqi National Revolt, in which 10,000 Iraqis were killed and the British lost 2,000 troops. The name of the town is Fallujah. It's not a coincidence that this was the hardest nut to crack in all of Iraq. This is not a town full of Ba'athists. The Ba'ath Party never had a very strong presence in this town because they're all extreme radical religious Sunni fanatics. The Ba'ath Party is a secular party. The Ba'ath Party had a very superficial presence there. It is full of tough characters, some of whom, it is true, are quote-unquote foreigners, unlike General Sanchez and General Kimmett and so on. They are foreigners. It's absolutely true. They are foreigners. They may be related to the people in Fallujah. They may have lived half of their lives in Fallujah. Their great-grandfathers may have traded in Fallujah. Their great-great-great-great-grandmothers may have come from Fallujah, but they are foreigners. They carry Saudi passports, or they carry Syrian passports. But, you know, I mean, they've been coming up and down that desert highway for millennia. And those ideas, good, bad, or indifferent, have been there for generations. And this is a place which is such a symbol of Iraqi nationalism that when the United States negotiated, when the Marines who were surrounding Fallujah, trying to take Fallujah last month, were negotiating with the insurgents, the man they called on was the grandson of Sheikh Dari. He is the spokesman of the Council of Sunni Ulama in Baghdad because of the prestige accruing to his family, because they're the people who are seen as sparking the Iraqi national revolt. So the guy who helped save our face in Fallujah is the grandson of the man who sparked the 1920 revolt against the British. We ignore these things at our peril. Let me read you one more brief quote. The people of England have been led in Mesopotamia into a trap from which it will be hard to escape with dignity and honor. They have been tricked into it by a steady withholding of information. The Baghdad communiques are belated, insincere, and incomplete. Things have been far worse than we have been told. Our administration more bloody and inefficient than the public knows. It is a disgrace to our imperial record and may soon be too inflamed for any ordinary cure. We are today not far from a disaster. Our unfortunate troops, Indian and British, under hard conditions of climate and supply, are policing an immense area, paying dearly every day in lives for the willfully wrong policy of the civil administration in Baghdad. There is not one word that I have read you that is not applicable to our situation in Iraq. This was written by T.E. Lawrence in August 1920. The height of the revolt against the British. Thank you very much. Yeah. Yes, sir. Okay, the questioner asked, what is the best way to, how do we get people to get George Bush out of the White House? I actually think that American public opinion is changing quite rapidly on this issue. I think that what happened in April, when 140 soldiers died, we don't know how many Iraqis died. We never know how many Iraqis died. 140 of our soldiers died in 1 month. We're now at 797 American servicemen and women killed. We're almost halfway to where the British were during their suppression of the rising.
Three more were killed today?
Pardon me?
Three more were killed.
I didn't hear that. That would bring us to 800. That would bring us to 800. I think that the American people are beginning to recognize, starting with what happened in April and then most clearly with this prison scandal, that this administration led us down the garden path. I don't know when Senator Kerry is going to finally speak for the overwhelming majority of Americans on this issue. I don't know if he will. I sincerely hope that he will. My only hope is that public opinion will shift so rapidly that however unwilling he is to take a stand on this, he will be forced to do so. I really think it is quite important, not only that the unilateral course that this administration has taken be changed, not only that we not launch other foolish adventures like this one, but that this occupation be wound up as rapidly and as decently as possible. I only hope that I think it has to be done before January, before the inauguration. If not, it will not be a good thing. I only hope that Senator Kerry will change his position on this. That's all I can say. Let me just say one thing about public opinion. One of the most encouraging things I have seen in the past year is how much of a change there has been in the bookstores I go into, especially in places like airports, where what you usually get is dreck, drivel, garbage. The front of every bookstore is full of political books. You can get Noam Chomsky's books. You can get Molly Ivins. You can get Clark's book. People on airplanes are reading Clark. They used to read, I don't know, Belva Plain and Stephen King and I don't know what. They're reading Clark. There has been a change. Now, obviously, most Americans get their news, God help us, from television. The majority of Americans get their main news source is television, which is to say the functional equivalent in the 21st century of Pravda, Trudin, Izvestia. You get MSNBC, CNN, and Fox. But a very large number of Americans get their news from, learn about things from radio, from books, from the internet, from newspapers. And it is very encouraging to me that so many political books are being published. Yes, the question is, the questioner asks, in my short analysis of what the United States was doing, I mainly talked about what the United States was doing and not why there was a change in the perception of the United States in the Arab world. In fact, in the book, I do go into this. And you're right in what I understand you to be saying in your question. There were a number of things going on in the Arab world. One of them was a trend towards non-alignment. People in the Middle East didn't really want to be aligned either with the Soviet Union or with the United States. It was very difficult for them to do that, and many of them ended up aligned with the Soviet Union. Most of these countries were not particularly inclined towards communism. That was read in the United States as if you're the friend of my enemy, you're my enemy. And so especially in the 60s, you had quite a separation between most Arab countries and the United States, and that was driven partly by the way in which Arab politics were moving. So yes, there were all kinds of reasons for people becoming alienated from the United States. Among other things, the fact that the United States had this drive in the 50s and into the 60s for bases in the area, and these people had just finished getting rid of the British and the French, and the United States said, "Well, to fight the Cold War, we need bases against the Soviets," and said, "We don't want to be part of the Cold War. We don't want to give you bases." And that non-alignment was seen very poorly in Washington, and it was really one of the especially during the Eisenhower administration. It's something I touch on in the book. I mean, there's a lot more that could be said about that, though. Yes, sir. I've been asked this question many times, and it's what is the real difference between a Kerry and a Bush? It's either going to be the questioner asks. It's either going to be imperialism with a kind face or imperialism with an ugly face. Is that what you said? Okay. The United States has hegemony in the modern world. What the questioner said, what you said, is in some measure true. But there is, in my view, a difference between the Clinton, George H.W. Bush policy, whereby the United States exercises its hegemony in a variety of ways, and between the quantum leap that is taken by the Bush people. The United States has exercised its hegemony in many cases multilaterally, in many cases through manipulating international institutions, in many cases through its ability to control the processes of globalization. It can be argued that this is extraordinarily objectionable, whether you're talking about the manipulation of the United Nations, whether you're talking about economic processes, whether you're talking about the kinds of coercion that the United States has exercised. I would suggest, however, that the Bush administration's drive for domination is something which is qualitatively different. Now, I don't know what John Kerry will do if he's elected, but I do not believe that these extraordinarily radical doctrines, which are put forward by the Bush administration openly, I mean, you just have to go back and read what they say, would be followed by a Kerry presidency. Now, that doesn't mean the United States will suddenly stop being a hegemon. That does not mean that the United States is suddenly going to stop through globalization, through other processes, dominating all kinds of things the world over. The world stays as it was, and we still have to deal with that, however we're going to deal with that. But I actually believe that this is a particularly dangerous, particularly virulent, particularly nasty strain of imperialism. And it represents a qualitative change over what we've seen in every administration that preceded it. Okay, last question. I have a lot to say. What is my take on Chalabi? Ahmed Chalabi is a man who first made his name by embezzling several hundred million dollars from the depositors in his bank, Petrobank in Jordan. Many depositors in that bank were ruined, including many good friends of mine. He escaped from Jordan. He was convicted of embezzlement and bank fraud, and is under sentence for those things in Jordan. He was picked up by our State Department and our Central Intelligence Agency, which in their wisdom decided that he was a suitable agent to work in Iraq against Saddam in the 1990s. They unfortunately found out when a private accountant, I don't know which accountant, some major accounting firm, checked into the money they had given him, that he could not account for much of the money they had given him. And they decided that he was therefore not just a thief, I don't want to say thief of Baghdad, thief in Amman, but that much worse than that, he had stolen from us. That was our money. That was our money, our tax dollars. And so from that moment on, they had nothing to do with him. He was picked up by his good friends in the Pentagon. He had gone to the University of Chicago, where he met Paul Wolfowitz. And Paul Wolfowitz and he are good buddies from way back. And so Wolfowitz rehabilitated him. Wolfowitz took him on board. Wolfowitz gave him his 300-something, or saw to it that he received $300,000 a month, which comes to close to $4 million a year for the last I don't know how many years. And he has recently been unmasked as the fraud that he is. He is responsible for much of the false intelligence on which this administration based its false premises for its illegal war. Thank you very much.
This program was produced by the LA Sound Posse. The LA Sound Posse records speeches and events dealing with social justice issues. We anti-copyright these recordings and share them via the internet, via community radio, and as CDs distributed through grassroots social justice groups, nonprofit organizations, committed individuals, and others. Our goal is to be part of the creation of a broad-based, participatory, and democratic civic media in support of the creation of a truly democratic society. You can reach us on the web at www.lasoundposse.org. Contact us for copies of this program on CD, or you can download it for free at www.radioforall.net. That's radio, the digit 4, all.net. If you valued what you heard in this program, please feel free to copy and distribute it to others who you think would benefit from hearing it, thus becoming yourself part of a decentralized, democratic civic media. Thanks very much for listening.